Start again.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for listening to our podcast. Tiffany and I give our all to this podcast with curating information, researching platforms, and creating a show with the best up-to-date information we can. We have a vested interest in the growth and health of your business and hope you feel the same way about us. We've joined Patreon. Become a patron for as little as $5 a month, and you'll gain access to our community, exclusive behind-the-scenes, speaker access, publicity for your business, webinar discount opportunities, and more. Please support us so that we can continue supporting you. And I'd also like to point out that if you would like to sponsor our show, sponsor an episode, we will not say no.
Email us
and let us know at the business behind smallbusiness@gmail.com. Anyway, hello and welcome to the business behind small business. Whether you're selling or staying, we're here to remind you that just because you own a business does not mean you are a business owner. Sorry to say. We are your hosts, Savannah Stone and
Tiffany Kao.
And we're going to get down into the nitty gritty to walk you through the more finite details of entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. revealing the dots between startup and success. No one gets to a million without getting a little dirty. There's a lot of business behind small business, so let's get to it. So today's episode is going to be an exciting one. It's full of mystery, mayhem, TikTok influencers.
She's really building up the suspense.
I really
now.
Am. Well, it's not so much the influencers as what they say in their viral videos. I feel like I'm on a one-person quest to dispel TikTok and bring it down. There's a lot of misinformation that gets spread through social media. Surprise, surprise. Mm. And most of all, we find it's usually from the financial industry people, because I'm not even going to touch the political.
Well, there are only so much things you can explain in a 1 minute short video.
For sure.
Surprise, you can't get it all in.
But I mean, you can tell the truth. Anyway, they'll say what they can to get those likes and follows, but do they really know what they're talking about? We're going to get to the bottom of all of those sneaky social media peeps with the help of our special guest, Phil Gaudiano of Polygon Advisory. Phil is a no-nonsense guru, of which you will not find him spreading untruths on the Twitter Gram book talk. You like that?
Wow, you
I did it.
Yes, good job. Didn't even stumble over it.
No, he's a CPA. Yes. His Polygon Advisory is also a tax advisory firm, and he's going to set the record straight. So we are going to get to the juicy center of TikTok tax truths or tales.
That's good. Phil's still with us. He hasn't gone running for the
hills. That's good. Yet. That's good. And I'm so proud of myself for not
sticking through that whole intro.
I totally did it. Before we begin, please note our disclaimer. This is available in both our show notes and on our website and should be referred to before and or after this podcast. Hi, Phil.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for choosing to be a part of our journey through the Tiki Talkies. And we are so excited to dispel some of these things. And hey, maybe some of the things that we're going to review.
Some might be true.
And since neither of us specialize in taxes, we thought we would talk to you. But before we get into some of these true or falses, let's learn a little bit more about you and how you got into your field and what makes you special.
Yes, sure. Thanks. So I'm a CPA. I've got a little bit over a decade of experience doing primarily tax work. Most of what I do is small business and individual related. And I do also have a small focus on crypto, but more importantly in the small business space. I took a course while doing my accounting degree on taxes, and it was just something that really piqued my interest, and I decided to make a livelihood out of it, and I've been doing it ever since. So that's what we do. I'm a co-founder of Polygon Advisory Group. We're a local firm. I mean, myself and my founder both live here in Virginia, but it's entirely remote. So we've got staff across the U.S. and staff overseas. Everything we do is remote based, so we never actually have in-person meetings. We don't have an office or anything like that. So we serve clients all over the place. And that's what we do. We just do taxes all the time.
So you were remote before there was remote popularity.
Yeah, COVID kind of like proved our business model. It was
we were already here.
I
hear you. A bunch of people in your playground.
I hear you. I was like, I already knew.
Wow, Phil, you took a course and then you're like, this is what I want to do?
Well, when you know, you know. It just hit me, and I really liked how it all worked, and it made sense to me. And I like the fact that it's it's rules based, and there's some room to wiggle around within the rules, but not a whole lot of room. Certainly not the amount of room that I'm sure you guys will ask me about seeing on TikTok. So from that end, it just kind of made sense to me. You know, it's very logical.
All right. Now, let's start diving into some of these questions. So I'm going to ask the first question, and this is a two-part question. So this is a true or false, and these are all, by the way, for our listeners, these are all things that we have heard or seen on social media.
Yeah, we're not going to name any names.
We're not naming any names, but we did pull these directly from
very fresh,
very viral fresh videos. Yes.
They are from people you've heard of, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
And slips in into your feed, so you probably heard this in some shape or form.
Yes.
I'm telling you, they all say the same thing.
They really do. Yeah. And
all the TikTokers, YouTubers are all talking about the same topics.
Yes.
That's strange.
And I will say that doing research for this was not fun for me. Oh. I had to watch more than I ever wanted to watch, and I didn't enjoy it. And even my son, the only kid I have left at home, was like, "So you're into TikTok now?" And I was like, "I'm not.
I'll tell you one thing though, and I assume, Phil, you do not sit there and like go through all these like TikTok and shorts and stuff like that.
No, I like the like cat videos, and I like guys falling down and
Absolutely.
Stuff like that. Yeah, but no, I stay away from the tax stuff.
Yeah, me too. Right, but now doing this, I'm kind of like, it all sounds too good to be true.
For sure.
So we're gonna find out.
So for example, here's one: buy a house with your business's money under your business's name, and then rent from your business. And then the second part of that same question is, we want to talk a little more about the Augusta rule that everybody's talking about. So these are two different questions, but I feel like they're both under the same context of buying a home.
And it goes the other way too. Somebody else was talking about you already owning the house, and then you're just renting it to your
business. Yeah.
For the 14-day allotment under the Augusta rule. And then that way you can get the expense on your business, and it's also tax-free income to you. So
yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we'll kind of unpack this one issue at a time. So
yes.
The first thing I think you said was buying a house under your business's name, mm-hmm. and then renting it personally from your business. Yeah, that's an idea that works, but it doesn't really have the tax effect that a lot of people think it will. The reason being is that, you know, the income is going to accrue to the business, and then the business is going to have to pay higher taxes on that. And then you get into all these other issues, like assets owned by a business are generally depreciable. And if you're renting out a home, generally it's depreciated. So you're going to have to, you know, recognize recapture of that when you sell the home. That's going to increase the business's taxes. And then there's all sorts of carve outs for personal homeowners, for primary residence owners. The biggest one being Section 121, which is the gain exclusion on the sale of a primary residence. If you sell your house as a person, or if you're married, if you have a spouse and you sell it as a couple, you're able to exclude a pretty good portion of that gain from taxation. So if you're single, it's $250,000. If you're married, it's $500,000. Businesses don't get that. That's a part of the individual tax code, not the business tax code. Hmm. So if you buy a house under your business and then rent it out, I kind of see what they're trying to do, because it seems to me like they're trying to capture some of that depreciation expense, which might help the business out a little bit. But you're really shooting yourself in the foot when you think about the long-term planning here. You know, you got to begin with the end in mind. And if you're ever going to sell your house, and you probably will, then it's probably best just to own it as a person. And then the other part of that was the Augusta rule. The Augusta rule, it's one of those weird ones. It's called the Augusta rule because that's where the Masters golf tournament is. And it was a rule that was made for the
was named after golf.
Yeah, it was named after a golf tournament. I mean, it's not called the Augusta rule in the tax code.
Was it created on a golf course?
Probably. I think a lot of this stuff probably was, when you get down into it. But basically what that means is that you're allowed to rent your personal residence for up to 14 days a year and not recognize rental income. So this has kind of been, exploited as a loophole in tax TikTok and tax Twitter and things like that. Where you can, if you own a closely held business, technically speaking, the business can rent your home for up to 14 days a year for things like, company meetings, shareholder meetings, things like that. That's true. You can do that. But where people get into trouble is saying that they're going to pay, $10,000 a day to rent the house or something like that.
So they have an outrageous, unreasonable rent.
Right. So what you really need to do if you're going to go through with this plan, and it's fine, it works. It's a good way to get cash out of your business, right? Because it goes directly into your pocket and there's no income recognition on you personally, but there's an expense on the business. So it works in that way. But really what you need to do is determine like what the fair value is of like an office rental in your area. So go, look on like Regis or like, WeWork or something like that and figure out how much it would cost you to get a conference room for the day, wherever you live and, or closest to where your house is. And that's probably about the rent you should stay around. And it's not going to be 10 grand.
Well, like say for example, like a shared office space, a conference room is maybe $50, right? For a 10 person conference room per hour. Mm-hmm. Right. So you think you're doing a company retreat, 8 hours of that. It's not anywhere close to $1,000. Nor close to $10,000.
Right. Right.
So you're saying like that stuff, like that's what you
should be doing.
You
right?
can say, yeah, that's acceptable.
Yeah, I would say that could work. And then along with that, you actually have to document a meeting having taken place. You can't what? Just...
There's documentation?
Everything we do is documentation.
What do you mean?
That's the most important part of taxes, Like, it I'm doesn't sure matter...
All your clients love documenting.
It's such a drag. It really is. But, I mean, when you get into these audits and you're talking on the phone to the IRS, that's it at the end of the day. That's all they care about.
If you can't prove it, right? Like if you don't have shareholders meeting notes or just a meeting note or even a calendar that says this is the retreat, like you can't prove yourself.
Well, would a remote meeting work? Does that count for remote meetings?
Well, do you need a space for a remote meeting?
Guess not.
Yeah.
See, I mean, nice try. That's one thing. Like my company doesn't have, rent on its income statement because we've never rented space.
Yeah. Plus, on air saying that we're a completely remote company.
No, but I am a remote company. So I'm wondering, like, I have a monthly meeting. I have weekly meetings and I have monthly meetings. So would that count? But if they're remote, then I guess they don't. So
right, right. It's really based on physical presence.
Yeah, like quarterly meeting, I want to bring all the staff,
everybody
into my house. Yeah, yeah. That could count.
That could work. Okay. That could work.
Okay. Interesting. So from what I understand is... buying a house using your business money and your business name is probably a little bit less
advantageous
than what it sounds like, right? And so breaking it down, my simple mind, it just means that you're bringing in income because you're renting your house out to the business, but then you're also trying to, like, you're deducting depreciation, but it's probably not as much as you think, depreciation, to offset that income.
Yeah, I mean, it might, if real estate is structured correctly, you should do it so that you show like a zero or even maybe a little loss on the income statement. And that's kind of the purpose, not the purpose, but that's one of the reasons why real estate is such an attractive investment is because you can shield some cash flow by using depreciation. And you can do the same thing with a business. Right. So, I don't think that the tax hit would be that bad on the business if you, as long as you're not charging some ridiculous rent, from yourself, which you wouldn't do, obviously. Right. But no, the real disadvantage is just on the back end of it.
When you're trying to sell the property, right?
You don't sooner or later, you're going to sell the house. You're going to have ordinary income, from all the recaptured depreciation. and you're going to get, you know, you lose the 121 exclusion and you're going to pay capital gains on the rest. And depending on what type of business it is, you might pay more tax and capital gains than you would as an individual, because individual rates on long-term gains are, you know, 15%. Corporate rates are 21%. Doesn't matter if it's long-term or short-term. Income is income to a corporation.
So I know this is a little off, not necessarily off topic, but off TikTok. I do wonder, I will say that in my community, in my world, what have you, I know a lot of business owners who the first thing they do when their company starts making money is buy commercial real estate, start investing their company's money into commercial real estate. And they're like, oh yeah, that, and like, because one person did it and it worked out for them, then everybody starts doing it. And so that's advice that I've gotten a lot of.
Is that like, because you tend to hold commercial real estate a lot longer? Is that?
I don't know. Like what, it's not exactly a TikTok thing, but like, what are your thoughts on that? When a business has started making, accumulating an X amount of income, now start investing it into commercial property.
Yeah, by all means. I think that's a great idea. You know, I like real estate, but I think it's important, you know, from a liability perspective and from a structuring perspective, to work with an attorney to make sure that you're doing it in an effective way. What I mean by that is, you know, generally speaking, an operating company, I tend to think that operating companies shouldn't own real estate. You should own real estate in a separate sort of holding company. Mm-hmm. And then your operating company can rent that from your holding company or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you had to explain the difference between a holding company and an operating company to somebody who's in the third grade level, how do we break that down exactly?
And man, how long is this podcast? no, I think
this
I
is what you're really here for.
Yeah. The easiest way to say it is that, you know, a holding company holds assets and an operating company does business.
Essentially runs business.
Now, you know, there's gray lines there, because like an or a holding company can rent its assets, and technically that's a business, things like that. But generally speaking, you want to structure it so that there's some sort of separation legally because of you know, liability protection. So if you're running, I don't know, a t-shirt shop or something like that, and you've got a chance to own the building, to buy the building, you could do it in a way where you fund a new LLC or fund a new company that buys the building, and then the t-shirt shop rents from that company. And what that would mean is, if somebody's in your store and they slip on the wet floor and break their leg and sue you for $1 million, the building's not at risk. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a tax strategy so much as it is just a liability strategy.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yep. To keep that separate.
Yep. And you want to talk to a lawyer about that. I know the tax law, you know, fairly well. Well, some of it fairly well. But I, you know, from a legal perspective, you want to get a lawyer's opinion on all that.
Now, is that something that you do often? Do you find yourself on the phone call with lawyers, or do your clients typically kind of have two separate conversations?
It depends on the client. You know, I definitely have clients where me and the lawyer will kind of team up on things. And then others, it's a, you know, kind of a call and answer. If they need something, I'll help them out. Or if I need something, they'll help me out. But it's good to have, you know, different advisors for different areas. You know, what I do is different than what a bookkeeper does. It's different than what a lawyer does, different than what a financial advisor does. And so, you know, if you're going to be serious about business and serious about, you know, I imagine this is all like the path to wealth creation. That's what the buzzword is now. It's important to have all these people in place so that, you know, you have someone to talk to when different issues come up. And that's something I say, you know, in client meetings all the time. Somebody wants investment advice. Hey, I don't do that. Go talk to your advisor, or I'm happy to call them with you. Or they want legal advice. I can't do that. I'm just the tax guy. So let's call your lawyer. But it's important to have those resources available.
Cool.
Very cool.
All right.
Moving on to the next one.
Yeah, we probably should, because I have like 50 more questions in regards to this. I don't think we have that kind of time.
So to summarize, yes, commercial real estate, likely better idea than residential real estate.
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, if you're going to set that up, you want to buy it through your company, make sure you talk to a lawyer and your tax.
Yes. Yeah,
well, I'll say residential real estate isn't a bad idea.
Okay.
To buy and set up through a company and rent out, so long as you're not the one renting it.
Got it.
So, okay. Yeah, buy all the properties you want and rent them to as many people as you want. But from a tax standpoint, there's no real benefit if you're one of the ones renting.
Oh, renting it to yourself.
Right.
So
exactly.
You're just talking about like a rental business.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Okay.
I love this because I can't tell you how many videos I have seen of these multimillionaires who are like, I don't own a house. I've never owned a house. And then it's because my business owns my house or my houses or whatever. And I just go bounce from house to house. And it's like, that can't be true. Okay. Sorry.
I'm sure there's people doing it, but this is going to be kind of a morbid thought and maybe you cut this out of the final podcast, but wait to see when those guys die, how mad their kids are that they don't get a step up in basis.
Really sure you want me to cut that out?
I would not want
to. But so that's true. We would have to have a whole other podcast to actually discuss what basis means.
Yeah. That's a way bigger.
Understands.
Right. Now. Right.
Yes.
And why don't we have more time? Anyway. Okay.
We do,
but I don't know that we would have everyone's attention. Maybe like in
part two, part three, part four, part five. Okay, so moving on to the next one, let's talk about putting your kids on salary. So this is something that's heard of a lot on TikTok, which is, this tax loophole of being able to put your kids on salary, setting up some kind of IRA account, and then you have to pay them a certain amount, and then they can go invest that in investments, which will then grow over time. And then because of compounding interest, you may pay in like a few $100,000 today, but in 60 years time, your kid will have like $9 million.
Yeah. No, it works with caveats. Like okay. I will say that this is a good plan. If you have a business and you have work in that business that your kids can do, then it makes total sense to hire them. But where TikTok gets it wrong and Twitter gets it wrong is they say, just put your kid on the salary, give them a W-2 for $12,000 or whatever the standard deduction is, $12,600, and then throw it in a Roth IRA and they'll be millionaires. Yeah, that's true. But again, like with the what we were talking about earlier with the Augusta rule, you have to document this stuff. So you can't just give your kid 12 grand for nothing. The IRS wants you to have what they call a contemporaneous written log, which means, you've got to track your kid's hours. And you've got to pay them a reasonable salary. So a lot of people, And so a lot of people, you hear on TikTok, the big thing now is child models. Like you take a picture of your kid,
right?
And you put it on
content,
Exactly. Yeah, it's like a financial advisor will like take their kid in the woods and hold their hands and get a picture of like the path to the future or whatever for their advertising, and then they want to pay the kid 12 grand for that. Well, I'm pretty sure you can call like some sort of agency that does child models and get a kid for a lot less than 12 grand for that. So it's it depends on the market rate. It depends on the documentation. I hire my kids. My kids, scan documents for me.
Oh, you they put sweep. Them to work.
Yeah. They open the mail. They do all sorts of like menial jobs. Yes. And I pay them, $15, $20 an hour, certainly not $1,000 an hour.
Yeah.
But it's, it's in line with what I might expect to pay someone else to do that same job. And that's really the big issue with a lot of this stuff on TikTok is there's nothing necessarily wrong with the strategies that are being promulgated out there, but it's in the execution because everybody just sees, this one little area and they just think we're going to cram as much as we can into it. And if there's legitimate work that you would pay other people $12,000 to do inside your business, then I have no problem with you paying your kid to do $12,000 to do that same work. But if you're just making up hours and giving them a paycheck, that's where it kind of falls through. And while we're on the topic, it's a Roth IRA. That's the best thing to do for a child because if you keep them under the $12,000 or $12,600. That's what the standard deduction is, which means they're not going to pay any tax. The disadvantage of a Roth account is that the current contributions aren't deductible, but when you're not paying tax anyway, it's not a disadvantage. And the huge advantage of a Roth account is that when you take distributions in the future, those won't be subject to tax. So it's money that's, the tax is already paid on, and it's permanently outside the scheme of U.S. taxation, which is the best ticket in town. You know, you can't get that kind of treatment anywhere else. And if you do it for your kids, you know, if they're 10, 12, 14 years old, you can't take any money out of the account until they're 59 and a half.
Yes.
So, you know, that's 45, 50 years in the stock market. So it's probably going to grow substantially.
It's a save almost too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great idea if it's done right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that these people who say these things to me with their 2-year-olds and their 4-year-olds probably don't have your 2-year-old on your payroll.
Yeah. I would wait until the kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would wait until the kid can at least like do some sort of office tasks, you know, sweep the floor, take out the trash, something like that. But a 2-year-old, you know, you're going to have a tough time selling that when you're sitting across from an IRS agent.
So I can think about somebody, you know, hearing this and going, well, I mean, come on, what are the chances that this will ever be found out or ever be caught?
Mm-hmm.
Like, does the IRS really care about something as medial as $12,000 a year?
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't say that you should play the audit lottery, and I don't advise anyone to do that.
Audit lottery, I like that.
That's part of the code of ethics that I ascribe to as a CPA. I mean, you know, that said, the chances are low. I mean, audit rates are historically low, but there is always that chance that you are going to be the one who gets audited. And, you know, moreover, it's just like, it's a sleep at night thing.
Yeah.
You know, do you want that hanging over your head where 3 years from now or 5 years from now, you might get a letter in the mail that says, we don't think your kid really worked for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's scary anytime you get a letter from the IRS.
That is whether so
it's,
true.
Yeah, whether it's good or not. You see the envelope, but it says Internal Revenue. And
oh, what happened?
Yeah, I have clients that won't even open them. They
just
come,
give it you to know, you?
Yeah, they forward it to me for me to open because they can't even handle, you know, the letter. The
trauma of it all.
Yeah, it's terrifying. So it's one of those things where, you know, just do it right and you can sleep at night and you don't have to worry about it. There's ways to get your kid up to $12,000, but... Yeah. You know, you got to make them work for it.
Well, I will tell you that even just, I mean, that, not that I know any of these people personally, but I've come across just in business of people who have been audited by the IRS, have been penalized, and have to go through the whole thing. So it's not like such a remote, like, it's not a remote event by any means. Like, it's enough that you have people near you that probably have been audited. Now, nobody goes around, you know, waving this out loud. But,
right.
You know.
Well, you know enough, and I know enough individual people that we don't know that are not the same person that I would not play the audit lottery.
Yeah. Yep. It happens more than you think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what I'm saying is it does happen a lot more than you think. Yeah.
Yeah. The way I usually describe it is that they may be slow as a sloth, but man, they do. They get you. There is no getting them off you. Then you are done.
Yep.
So. You don't want to do that. You're right. You want to be able to sleep at night. Okay, so this is an awesome one. Create an LLC, buy land with your LLC, and then rent that land out to a local farmer or cattle rancher or whatever, and get agricultural credit.
No.
Flat out no.
it's the answer. The answer to every question that I answer is it depends, right? And what? So
now it, you sound like a lawyer.
Well, there's different ways that you can rent farmland. You know, you can do a cash lease where a farmer just pays you X dollars a month.
Define this agricultural credit first. Like, what is that? How much is it? Like, is it that big of a deal that people
There's all sorts of different credits and carve outs and deductions for agriculture. You know, there's things for like conservation and wastewater management. There's 179 expenses for land improvements and things like that. So agricultural credits can mean all sorts of different stuff. And it really depends on how you as a landlord are paid. So if you're just renting land for money, for cash, if a farmer gives you $1,000 every month, then it's just rental income. It's going to be on Schedule E, you know, real estate rental. If instead you're given like a share of the crop, then it'll probably wind up on one of the farming forms, Schedule F, or the other one. I think it's 4600 or 4800 series form. I don't know off the top of my head. But the distinction there depends on whether or not you have any sort of role in it. So like if you're paying for part of the farmer's expenses, or if you're giving them advice on, you know, how to farm, I don't even know what that means, how to till the land, or which, you know, direction to face in the sun. Yeah, it's really, and listen, and I'm not an expert on this by any means. This is just kind of general concepts. If you do plan to do this, you should talk to a CPA who spends a lot of time in the farming space and works with a lot of farmers. Yeah, we're like everybody. I mean, you know, just like lawyers and doctors, we all have our own specialties. And I would tend to stay away from farms just because I don't see them much.
Well, my guess is from the sound of it, and I assume this was from a really quick TikTok, you know, thing, right? But the sound of it is that it sounds a lot more passive than it is in real life, would be my guess, right? Like, oh, it sounds like just, you know, buy land, put it under LLC, and it just rent it out and just collect income. Like, that's it. And that's, you know, that you get a credit from that. But there probably is, just like everything else we've talked about, there's probably underlying things you actually have to do. Like you said, you probably have to play some kind of active role in it that gets cut out of these TikTok videos. So
the thing with TikTok now is, you know, everybody's on this passive income kick, and it's, you know, buy a bunch of houses, buy a bunch of farmland.
It's not real passive income.
Go to yard sales and flip stuff on eBay. And it's like, that's a lot of work. You know, let's put together 10 or 12 side hustles. Well, yeah, but now you got 10 or 12 jobs. Like, there's not a whole lot of passive income that's actually passive until you get bigger and you can step away and have other people do it for you.
You've worked at it for a while, too. So it's pretty active up front. And then you put in a foundation for it to be passive. But it's not passive from day one.
Absolutely not. And you're also dividing your focuses. Like, what is going to be your focus? Is it going to be the five different houses and six different commercial pieces that, or whatever properties that you purchased and are actively trying to find people to rent from you? Or is it going to be the business that you started from the get-go and are trying to grow that? Like, what is going to be the thing you feed? At least that's how I see it. Like, what is going to be the thing you feed? And whatever it is that you feed is going to come back to you. But if you're dividing yourself into 12 different things, then you're going to get a little bit from 12 different things, or you're going to get a lot from one thing. That's how I see it.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. So
shall we throw another one?
Yes, we shall.
At you, Phil?
Sure. Go for it.
All right. Take it. You got it. All right. So this one is an interesting one, but I'm not surprised that this is all over TikTok, because again, it sounds very sexy.
It does.
So create two businesses or three to build a financial feeder circle, which I've never heard it called that before.
Well, you know, I didn't really know how else to...
Oh, you made that up.
I made the feeder circle part up.
Okay. I was like, I've never heard of this.
I didn't know how else. I was thinking circle of life. Like, one feeds the other, then feeds the other, then feeds the other. You know, like, so...
By the way, for anybody who's just listening to this, you really need to go see the video of what Savannah just did while she was talking. that was a lot of emotion.
It's visual.
Very visual.
You know, but like... I didn't know how else to mention it. Okay. I'm the one that writes these things, okay? Just in case anybody is wondering, but I write it. So one hand feeds the other.
Okay. For example, okay, so buy land with a property management company you own, would be my guess, right? Put your business on the land for your main operating company. Sell products and services to your main company. From your main company to your, what's the third company? To your third company.
So let's say, for example.
Operating.
Okay, so let's.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Like, you are, you own one company that owns the land. Mm-hmm. You put your building or whatever onto the land. Mm-hmm. And now you are, you know, whatever, the property management company, your business is on the land of that property management company. And then let's say you sell products or services and you have this additional company that will be either contracting to you. A lot of contractors do this. A lot of tradesmen like to do this.
Okay.
So for example, there is a company that I know that will not be named that owns a company that rents backhoes and, you know, different construction things to the main company. And then they also own a gravel service or soil or something like that. And they sell the quote unquote, for those who are not watching, the gravel to the construction company, So there's like,
sounds like a lot of related parties.
There's a lot of related, it's here. Kind of incestual, but
incestual is a better, I like that better than
the feeder circle.
Yeah. Feeder circle, which just sounds
more cannibalistic. A little
zombie.
Incestual might get you flagged though on, you know, iTunes or something.
Okay, we may cut that.
You might want to scrub that out.
Yeah.
Yeah, feeder circle. Right.
Curse all you want, but don't say the word.
Our podcast. But no, I kind of understand what you're saying, and you know, it kind of goes back to the discussion we had earlier, where you know we were talking about buying a house in a company, and I said it was not necessarily a bad idea to break apart a holding company and an operating company, and I would argue that, like in your example, Sona, with the quarry or whatever, that's getting the gravel and selling it to the contractor.
Yeah.
That as a unit, you know, somewhere along the line, income's going to flow to the top. Right. And so if you think of those two businesses as being related, the net amount of the total income, you know, that's absorbed by both of them, isn't going to change. Right. Because if the contractor pays a very reduced fee for the gravel that he gets from the self-owned gravel yard or the sister company or whatever. And then he then turns around and uses it in a project and charges the client, you know, $1,000, then he's going to have $1,000 of income and he's going to have almost no cost to write off against that. Mm-hmm. Whereas if he paid the gravel company, you know, $100, he'd have $100 to write off against that income. And so, you know, when you talk about these related parties as a tax saving mechanism, you know, really how this all makes sense, not really anymore since the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but it used to make sense to do this offshore, you know, where you could have transfer pricing, you know, and shift your income to low tax jurisdictions.
Yeah, that's true.
You can't really do that anymore. And within the states, you know, maybe you could do something between like Maryland and Virginia, where like if you own a lumber yard in Illinois, you know, you want to get the hell out of there. So you sell everything in Indiana or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's not, you know, at the federal level, there's not much cost savings involved in terms of taxes when you think about these two separate businesses as a unit.
Mm. You know, so it sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, right?
I could have used my own company as an example as opposed to using somebody else, but kind of like the same thing. Like my company offers three different services, so it wouldn't make sense for me to cut my company into three different organizations,
right.
three different entities, and then subcontract from one to the other, because either way, it's like six in one, half a dozen in the other, is basically
right. Maybe. Not from a tax perspective, but again, you know, a lawyer would see this differently, because if you own the quarry and a guy dies in the quarry, you don't want him taking the contracting business.
Gotcha.
So you keep the quarry as its own business, and then you keep the contracting operating company as its own business. That way, when the guy dies in the quarry, his family can't get your other business.
I understand.
So it's you know, we say like that, it sounds kind of dirty, but.
But it's kind of like it's a liability level. So I guess consider what the liability level is of the company that you own, and the amount of, I guess, revenue that your company has, or how many people are involved. Because I would imagine if you've got like 1,500 employees or so, less or more, it would make sense, especially if you are in a highly liable industry such as construction. Or quarry would be one of those two, any kind of like high level industry, high level liability.
So I think liability is probably a better reason to do this. And I think what happens is, I think what happens is online, people are selling it like this is a tax loophole. This is a great reason for tax. And if that's the reason why you're doing that, then you're probably just creating a lot of extra work for yourself, because all this needs to be accounted for, especially if you're going between.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And remember, with separate companies comes separate compliance costs,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, you've and then there's pay. Costs, right? Because then you have yeah. to, you know, file for every single company. And then
Yeah. That is definitely something that we should be
really think about the cost coming out of this. Yeah.
Right, right. But that, I'm glad that you guys said that, because I want our listeners to know that there is a cost that is associated with all of these things that we aren't even talking about, that we don't have the time to talk about. But imagine what the cost of all of these options is as well. Do you really want to be spending that much just to save just a little bit?
Do you think
bit?
The tax CPA, well, you know, it would be actually more compliance work for the CPA and the lawyers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you come to me with, you know, five businesses in a circle, I'll do them all for you, but I'm going to charge you for every one. You know?
My businesses, yeah. Because you actually have to file separate returns for every yep. single one of them. And you need to make sure they all make sense, because right. then that's a big red flag.
Right. But, yeah. And not to put this in too layman of a term, but it's kind of like, you know, my aunt would cut coupons like nobody's business. She would spend an entire day, not so much now because you don't have to anymore, but back in the day when you had to cut coupons. And I would say, I don't understand. You're going to save a few pennies and you spent your entire day, as opposed to doing anything else, cutting coupons just to save a couple of dollars. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Or you're going to four different grocery stores. Like, what about the cost of the gas to get to all of these grocery stores?
Yeah, I mean, and there's a quality of life issue too, right?
You know, for sure. Like,
yeah. Do you want to spend time with your kids, or do you want to keep five separate sets of books and talk all day on the phone to your lawyer to make sure you got all the forms filed and all that stuff?
Totally.
Yeah.
I think it's really, you need to sit down and figure out the cost, the benefit of this.
The benefit.
The rewards. Is it worth all the time and money? Because if all that just goes right out to, you know, speaking to all your advisors.
Yeah.
You know, charging you by the hour, then it's kind of like, well, really, what are you doing all this busy work for that, right?
Absolutely.
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
I like that, Phil. It's very practical.
Absolutely. That's why we're friends. Whenever you go out of, this is a good one. Whenever you go out of town, look for a business event that will be going on at the same time you'll be there. Buy a ticket for the event to make it look like you're going to that destination for the event, and then you can expense your whole trip as a business trip. Like it?
No, I don't like it.
Oh, no, Phil's taking off his glasses.
I don't like
it.
Listen, you can travel for business.
That's possible even before TikTok, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I mean, you can absolutely travel for business. If you're in the real estate business, you can go attend a real estate conference in New York or LA. If you're in the, you know, whatever business, you can go wherever you want and attend a conference that will help you in that business. But I would argue that the conference comes first. You know, there's a long history of people kind of like dovetailing official travel with pleasure travel. Mm-hmm. And that works fine. You know, if you find, you know, we're coming up now in another month or so, when I get out of the end of tax season, is when the tax industry starts having all their conferences, because yeah. nobody's doing anything.
Get all the CPEs in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, like, you know, I can fly to, you know, Miami or whatever and do a 2-day conference and then stay for a couple of days. But it's like anything else, you know, you've got to be able to ratio out the business and the pleasure elements of it. So if I were to fly to, you know, somewhere, with my wife, I brought my wife. So my plane ticket, obviously I need to get to the conference. That's fine. I can expense that, but my wife can't fly under the business. She's got no business, you know, learning what I do. And then, you know, if we stay in a hotel, okay, I need a hotel room for 2 days to attend the conference. So that's fine. But the other 3 days that we spend there, that's going to have to come out of my own pocket. And similarly with, you know, meals and things like that, or, you know, entertainment, whatever we do down there, it kind of all works the same way. Yeah. The whole question, like, to make it look like you went to the conference, like, you're not really keeping with the spirit of the law there. if you put that on the face of the question,
yeah,
you should, you know, appearances matter less than, you know, than facts and then actual like documentation. So I would have no problem, you know, if you want to fly to, you know, wherever, Tahiti, and attend a great conference for whatever you do, then by all means do it. But if you stay for 2 weeks, we're going to have to do some math and take out a good chunk of those expenses.
So I hear, don't get greedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know,
well, what I hear is that at least two of those days of your 2 week trip, you could expense.
So
to
don't
your
get
business.
Greedy and try to expense.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
Of
yeah. You know, it's, so it's the old saying is like pigs get fed, hogs get slaughtered. You know, so like you could do it a little bit. And that's what going to Tahiti would be, right? Because you don't need to go to Tahiti to learn about taxes.
No.
There's plenty of conferences that I can attend in, you know, within driving distance from my house.
Right.
But I might choose to attend one where I would have to fly and maybe I could spend a day on the beach. Right. So that's like a nice little perk. And you could do that reasonably under the business. Hmm. But then if you stay for, you know, another week, you gotta be honest with it at that point and say, hey, I got to take off those other 6 days. Those weren't really related.
Okay. All right. Good enough.
That's fair. So it can still take some.
It's okay. And it's not okay. I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like anything else, right? It's at the end of the day, all I do, you know, everything I do is just an allocation. And that's always the question, like business or personal, reigns over everything when you talk about small business, because there's constant commingling of funds. There's always people trying to get money out of the business for personal use or using the business to buy personal stuff. And so it's a big question that we see a lot. And the answer is documentation and math, right? Mm-hmm, and it's totally fine to ratio this stuff out. You know, you've got a cell phone, and if you can reasonably say that you use your cell phone, you know, 50% of the time for business, then I have no problem putting 50% of the cost on the books of the business. But 100% of the time, like, you tell me you're not calling your husband, you're not calling your kids, you know,
on.
You didn't call your college roommate and chat for an hour last weekend. I mean, there's definitely a personal element to everything, and you need to account for it.
Yeah, that's true.
So that is good. That's a good segue into our next question.
Yes.
Is cars.
Yeah.
Right. So year end comes around. There's a little more liability. Maybe you're doing a good job in planning with your CPA ahead of time. And I don't know if this is a TikTok thing, but I definitely have heard it in real life quite a few times where they're like, well, go buy, if you have extra liability, let's go ahead and get some more expenses in there. Go buy a luxury car, not even just a car. Go buy a nice luxury car.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, the whole thing is like it hinges on a number of things. First of all, businesses can own cars.
Mm-hmm.
Totally fine for a business to have a car or a truck or a van or whatever, an airplane, it doesn't matter. You can buy all that stuff under a business. But like we just said, there's going to have to be some sort of allocation between business and personal if you're also using that car for personal use. Where TikTok kind of goes crazy is with all the luxury auto limits and the 6,000 pound loophole. And so that's the thing where an SUV that's over 6,000 pounds is classified as a truck, according to the tax code. And there's no limits on a bonus and 179 depreciation that you could take on it. And so a lot of people will, you know, the popular one now is the G-Wagon, right? Which I think it's like the Mercedes. It's the one that looks like a tank, you know?
Yeah, it's a really big car.
I think it's a terrible car. I mean, it's not my taste, I'll say that.
Yeah.
I'd be mad if I paid 120 grand and the car looked like that. But anyway, a lot of people, you know, they talk about it. It's the greatest idea in the world. And it works, but what they're not taking into account is that, you know, they really should not capitalize the entire car to the business, because probably, you know, if you're an influencer, 99% of what you do is not work related.
You don't need to be in your car to do it. Okay.
No, and there's, look, like, I get it. If you're a salesman and you're driving from here to there, meeting clients, and you're the proverbial road warrior.
Sure.
You're in your car 5 days a week and you put, you know, 30,000 miles the first year. Then sure. Okay. I agree that you need that car for business. But, you know, if you're doing something, you know, if all you're doing for the business is commuting to the office every day, well, commuting's personal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't even count as business miles. So it's probably easier to just buy, you know, a reasonable car personally,
mm-hmm.
And then reimburse yourself for the miles that you drive for business purposes.
Mm-hmm.
That keeps it a lot cleaner on the books of the business than does, you know, bringing an automobile onto the books that doesn't really belong there.
Right.
And then there's other things too about, you know, it's tougher to get a car loan as a business. Mm-hmm. You know, the insurance rates go up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where you guys were, where the listeners are located, but in Virginia, on the personal side, you get half your car tax as a rebate. Businesses mm-hmm. don't get that. So you have to pay full thing. Yeah. So there's all sorts of these little things that can add up. And, you know, moreover, it's just requiring more record keeping. You know, because if you just do this and you never write anything down, you don't keep a contemporaneous written log of the miles you drive for business versus personal, and the IRS pegs you for it, you're going to lose the audit. And it's not even going to be a discussion. Mm-hmm. They're just going to say, no, that car is not a business car. And there's not much you can say about it, you know? So if you're not willing to go through the hassle of taking the time of keeping all those records, then you're probably better off just to do it on the personal side and get reimbursed.
Mm-hmm. So then it seems like, one, you need to figure out whether or not buying this car is a necessary business expense.
True.
Ordinary and necessary.
Necessary business expense. So like you said, an influencer who's at home with their camera may not necessarily need that little G-Wagon to be driving around town.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you like, you really want the G-Wagon and you can afford the G-Wagon pretty easily, mm-hmm. no one's going to say you can't have it. Just saying, don't take advantage of what you can use it for your company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Take the requirements of the tax code seriously.
Yeah.
Like, and this kind of goes back to like the audit lottery question, because maybe you're never caught, you know, maybe you buy a new car every year and nobody ever questions it and great. But maybe you don't.
Yeah. You know? It only takes once.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's just not a good idea.
I think the question to ask, and this is the question that I asked before I bought my car, is would I buy this car whether or not it had anything to do with my company?
Yeah.
And the other flip side of it too, is like you were saying, like the G-Wagon is what, like 120K or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that.
Right. And the question to ask is that really worth, like, if I was a business, like, and I had all that extra cash laying around and I needed to kind of deduct my business liability or my tax liability, I don't know if I would go spend it on a car versus buying something that can actually make me more money in the business the following year, right?
Yep.
Or
right.
in the future.
And the other thing to consider is, you know, when you talk about the value of a tax deduction, it flows through your marginal rate. So if you pay taxes at a 30% rate, and you spend $100,000 on a car, you only get the benefit of $30,000 back in your pocket. Mm-hmm. So that other $70,000 is still sitting out there. So it's not
that too. It's only
it's not a free car, you know, by any means.
No.
Sir, sounds like it on TikTok.
No. Oh, right, it does.
You get this free car, you can just put it on your books. It'll be fine on your company. Yeah, you can drive it around, and 100%.
Oh yeah. So I don't know that this is necessarily a bad thing to do. But putting all of your business expenses on a credit card and then paying it off each month with your business's checking account to earn credit or points. You know, there are some credit cards that have cash back or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't see the downside to that. Maybe you see it differently.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the IRS has ruled that credit card rewards, whether it's like points based or airline miles or cash back or whatever, they're not includable in income because it is essentially taken as a reduction in the underlying expense. So if you go out to dinner for $100 and you get 5% cash back, you get a $5 credit on your statement at the end of the month. That doesn't mean that you got $5 in income. It just means that dinner costs $95.
Right.
And so, you know, the same logic applies at the business level. Technically speaking, because businesses get the benefit of deductions, they should include those rewards points or the value of the cash back.
As an offset to the expense.
Right, exactly. And that's how we like
I'm
to
sure
do it.
Everybody does that, right? Everybody.
Oh, absolutely. There's
those Amex travel points.
Yeah, 100% compliance. It's never questioned. But what might make more sense if points are something that you're after, I would say to set up an accountable plan with the business. That's a simple document that says that the business agrees to reimburse business expenses paid by the owners or officers personally.
Mm-hmm.
And then just do it on your personal credit card.
Yeah.
And then you get into the rigmarole of, submitting expense reports and getting reimbursed by the business.
There's that word again, documentation.
Right. But it's, you know, you can set it up in a way that it's actually easy. And then the documentation kind of takes care of itself, because if you want to get money, you've got to, you know, submit this report. And if you're a single member LLC or, you know, a wholly owned business, you're submitting the report to yourself, obviously, but you can just stick it in the file or save it to Dropbox or, you know, whatever you use for documents. That's probably a better way to do it, because then all the points will accrue at the personal level. And then you could use them for
less,
you know,
messy.
Yeah, just way less messy.
There's no question that these points are business.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually something you said earlier brings up a good point. Would it make a difference whether or not you are sole proprietor, LLC, S corp, C corp? Like, would you say don't do it if you're an S corp? Don't do it if you're a whatever? Like, would you say that's kind of across?
You know, generally speaking, it's tough to do as a sole proprietor because there's not really a concept of an accountable plan there.
Yeah.
Because everything is done, you know, in your name.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the other business entities will allow you to do that. Certainly corporations, S and C corporations, okay. You can do accountable plans. Partnerships may or may not have some sort of accountable plan. You can also do unreimbursed partnership expenses, which kind of works the same way. It's just kind of an addendum to the Schedule E, where you reconcile partnership income that comes off the K-1. Okay. If you've got, you know, other expenses that you spent personal funds on for partnership business, you can claim them there.
Okay. I guess you probably have to put something in the operating agreement that says, you know, we'll reimburse the partner or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Be writing somewhere. You can't just willy-nilly just decide.
Right. And that's the thing. You know, we've got, for our clients, we've got this very simple document, which is a basic accountable plan document. And we send it, you know, if they're interested in starting one, we send it to them. We tell them to, you know, check with your lawyer. Nobody ever does because they don't want to get billed.
No.
But it's like, sign the document and stick it in the drawer. And it's one of those things that you're never going to need it.
Ever.
Right. But at least it's there.
So it sounds like this is something that is readily, like most, if not all, tax CPAs would know of and should be something that, you know, you can just mm-hmm. ask them and say, hey, do you have something that I could just use?
Yeah. Yeah. And like, more importantly, it puts the onus back on you to seek out the reimbursement, because
right.
more and more what you see happening, if you get a business credit card, if you look at the statement at the end of the month, very few people use it just for business.
Yeah.
You know, you see
true.
A lot of personal expenses come through there, and then you have to.
You mean those meals? No, those baseball tickets? No,
right.
No.
And then it's just a sloppy exercise of trying to figure out, you know, what
I
was.
I used to laugh at that, like the credit card statements people try to pass through. I'm like, really? Come
it's
on,
crazy.
You can at least make it seem somewhat reasonable. Like,
yeah.
Right.
No, the ski lodge? No.
Yeah, yeah.
I've seen many ski lodges too. So
yeah. I had a guy. One guy was using his credit card to pay his marina fees for his boat. And I was like,
because
I don't think that's.
You need to have a boat to.
He was, you know, he was a doctor, so it's not like he's taking out clients or anything like that.
Your patients are visiting you on the boat.
You're doing
unless
surgery
he's a marine
at sea.
Doctor.
But it's but it. And it may be, you know, it may be, you know, something that they do consciously, or it may just be that, you know, you're at the checkout and you reach in your wallet and that's the card that you whip out.
Yeah,
and, you know,
that's
and
something
so,
that's happened to me before.
But it just makes it, you know, it just makes it very messy. You know, we do everything we can to encourage people to, you know, not pierce the veil between the business and the individual. And so if you're doing things on a business credit card, it's much easier to throw personal expenses on there. If you're doing everything on a personal credit card and then you go through yourself at the end of the month and say, you know, this was business, add it all up and get a check cut from the business to reimburse you, just a lot cleaner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is definitely, you know, much more, less messy. It's a lot less messy.
Well, that's
that
if you're
way.
Trying
and
to get
also,
the points and everything. At the
oh
end
yeah,
of the
for
year,
sure.
Right?
Because yeah, I mean, I can't say that I haven't thought about that. I've actually been thinking a lot about that where I'm like, I'd really like to, you know, get a, I don't really have any credit cards with points. And like I am always hearing about people using mileage that they got from their credit card or whatever. And I'm like, I feel like I want to do that. So maybe, maybe I do that. Maybe I get a credit card that's got whatever points or
miles. I mean, the ideal situation.
But it's going to be in my personal name. Exactly, and then I can put my business expenses on it, but then also reimburse myself because I am also on my company's payroll. So part of my payroll can be reimbursements.
Because ideally it is, you have a business card, use it for business. Like don't mess around. Right. That's the ideal way to do it. But if you're really trying to go after these points and you're, you know, for some reason thinks that it's that important, then, you know, put it on your personal card, get the accountable plan, make sure you're doing all the paperwork, documentation and bookkeeping right. And then you can go enjoy those rewards.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you think are some smart tax saving tips from your perspective for a growing business?
Yeah, well, I think it's you know, it's the way that you look at it. First of all, you know, like we talked about in the beginning, aside from tax, you want to have a good team of people helping you because there's a lot of intricacies involved in running a business beyond just, you know, what you do day to day. There's tax elements, there's legal elements, there's financial elements, and all of those things need to be advised on. You need to be advised on all of them. And then, you know, consider the actual tax benefit you're going after. Versus, you know, the crazy things that you have to do and maneuvers that you have to make it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it's better just to pay the tax, you know, and that's coming from a guy who's dedicated his life to reducing people's taxes. It's a tough nut to swallow, but you know, it's one of those things where everything comes with a price, you know, and that price is in the tax world, that price is, you know, the potential of being audited, the potential of interest and penalties and things like that. But moreover, day to day, that price is just documentation, right? And nobody wants to do that.
Which takes time.
Yeah.
Right. It's time away from your business. It's time away from your family.
More money.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's one of those things where just really consider transactions before you undertake them and talk it out. You know, by all means, some of the stuff on tax TikTok and is probably fine, but you don't just, you know, much like you probably wouldn't buy a house or invest in a stock or something like that based on a 20-second clip. You probably shouldn't do that with taxes either. You know, you want to talk to people about this stuff before you dive in.
And then jam it into your H&R Block self-approved taxes.
Exactly.
I do feel like, that's funny you should say that, because I do feel like no one would do financial advice that way. Why are they doing tax advice that way? I am shocked by how many people I get approached by either current clients or potential clients who say, so what do you think about this thing that I heard about that blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you don't really want me to answer that, do you? Like, are we being serious right now?
But it's a question of regulation, right? Because like financial advice is very, very well regulated, and legitimate financial advisors can't go on TikTok and say, hey, you should buy the stock.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they'd get in a whole world of trouble. Tax preparation or tax advice is very well regulated for people who have credentials.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But there's a large contingent of unlicensed people who don't, you know, there's no one to answer to.
Yeah.
And then you've also got like the, you know, the gurus or whatever you call them, the guy that, you know, owns 500 self-storage units or the guy, you know, whoever's idea it was to buy a farm or whatever. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure he's got some ridiculous website where he owns, you know, 1,000 acres somewhere. There's all those people online. And they're not licensed by anybody. They report to no one. They're free to say whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who are saying all the stupid stuff. Yeah. Unfortunately, you know,
context, right? Because they have a team of tax accountants and advisors who are trying to figure all this out for them. And maybe it works in their life, like tax life, but it may not work for everybody else.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely dependent on facts and circumstances. And I'm sure that these people do have good teams underneath them. And he's probably got a guy like me, you know, who's sitting in the office somewhere and like scratching his head like, can't believe he said that, you know.
Never mention my name in any of these.
You know, it's funny because that was the whole precipice behind us, or the foundation behind us starting this podcast, was because we felt like a lot of podcasts are out there of people who are already millionaires, multimillionaires, who are giving their stories about, oh yeah, it's so easy, everybody can do it. And, you know, the whole point of the podcast, and has been the whole point, our vision, our mission, has always been about, no, you know what? Don't put yourself at the same level right now as that multimillionaire and think that the things that work for them are going to work for you. You got to start from step one. And once you've completed step one, now we can move on to step two.
Yeah.
And
it's like the same thing, the whole passive income thing, right? It sounds great. It's a great sound bite. Oh, it's passive. Like you can just almost sit back and just let money flow in.
For sure.
And what they're not saying is all this work that has to go into it. And there are people who take that and blindly just do it and fail and probably lose a lot of money. And that's kind of,
well, a lot of times they lose a lot of money by paying for the convention that will tell them how to save all this money.
Yeah. The whole fake it till you make it culture and all that, you know, like small business is hard work. And it has to be, because that's the trade-off, right? You're trading hard work for freedom, like both now and in the future. And the hope is that, you know, you make it big or, you know, whatever your version of big is. It doesn't have to be like a mansion on the cliffs overlooking the sea or whatever. Yeah. It can just be a nice, you know, home for you and your family. But that's kind of the whole idea here, is that you're building something for yourself.
Yes.
And so you shouldn't flub that up on, you know, some 2-bit suggestion about, you know, buying a G-Wagon.
Yeah, I do.
Because
it sounds like you're a millionaire overnight.
Yeah. When you're small, that could sink you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, if you have $1 million in the bank and you get audited, not such a big deal. You know, you pay some lawyers and throw some money at it. But if you're a real small business or if you're a startup, if you're just starting out and you get audited the first year for something stupid that you saw on TikTok, your business is probably gone. Yeah. You know? And that's something that's a real threat. So do it right.
Yes, I agree. So how many professionals would you say a business should speak to about money saving opportunities or investments and tax deductions? And at what point in the business's growth? So let's take it into a few different stages. The startup, and then at the startup point, at the, let's say, 5 to 10 year point, when things are starting to go into that next level, and then maybe at the not end, but
maturity.
Yeah. Like when you're either
a little bit more stabilized,
you've been doing this for a while, maybe you're ready to retire. Like how many professionals do you think a business should speak to in those three stages?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think you need more than one professional in each of the, you know, the areas. So you have to have, you definitely, you know, first and foremost, no matter what stage you're in, you need a competent bookkeeper, because that is what it's all based on, right?
That you do.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Plug for you, I guess. But that's, no, but it's true.
It's true. Like
that, the numbers tell the story of the business.
You're so funny. And you're also telling our listeners that, hey, if you're the bookkeeper, you better be confident. You're doing it yourself.
Well, that's another thing that I won't go into, but there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of incompetence in that area too. But not from you.
No, but I get what you're saying. What you need is not just and we've talked about this before. Like we've talked about what type of bookkeeper you should be having. It should not be the person, you know, a spouse or your child or something like that. Like it should be a competent person who has proven results with a proven history and a track record with experience. And I also venture to say that I personally think that, from my opinion, that it should be someone who is a part of a firm or a part of a company as opposed to an individual. And I say that based on the type of liability insurance that they have to cover, they have to have, and the type of liability that they can insure.
Yeah.
So that's my personal preference. And I'm not saying that because of me and my company. I'm just saying you don't have to go with me, but go with a firm or go with somebody who's more established as opposed to, I don't know, your neighbor who also happens to be a, you know,
bookkeeper. I would just say that no matter who you hire, even if it is a freelancer, ask them for the insurance and the documents.
For sure.
Absolutely.
Insured and actual, has all the actual business set
all
up
of
to
the
be legitimate. Especially if you want them to be messing around with your business finance.
Like, yes. Your business's money is
and your money,
heart.
Right? Like,
it is the heart. It is the organs of your business. And if the money is not being tracked appropriately, then how is your CPA going to know that, right? Like your CPA is going to get the paperwork based on the profit and loss, the financial reports, based on what it is that the bookkeeper has done.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not done correctly, then the CPA can't file correctly. I mean, like how would the CPA even know? Unless, of course, it's blaringly obvious. obviously I know that, but like there are some things that you're not going to recognize. And then if you file it wrong, it just, it goes right back to the bookkeeper.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. It, it all kind of compounds in on itself. And then beyond that, you know, a competent tax person, and then I would say a lawyer, those are probably the first three that you want to talk to, the lawyer for structuring, and, you know, for liability purposes and things like that. And then as you grow, you know, probably a financial advisor makes sense. If you need funding, it makes sense to have a banker in your court, you know? So, and those, and, the other guy you need or girl you need is, an insurance broker.
Yes.
Because as you grow, you know, you're going to want to insure certain things, both personally and through the business. So you need to have someone competent in that arena, you know, and when we move into that, you know, like bookkeeping lawyers and accountants, CPAs tend to be like the first people that you find. But the other three, the financial advisor, the banker, and the insurance person, tend to be like more kind of like belly to belly sort of like, you know, people that, you know, or that at least have worked with, you know, six or eight of your friends and everybody talks about them positively and things like that.
Yes.
But you know, at the end of the day, it's all just relationships. And so it's just people that you're comfortable with. You know, I would much rather you go with an accountant that you're comfortable sitting across the table from having a conversation with than somebody because they work for, you know, the biggest firm in town or whatever.
Yeah.
Because these are all people that you're going to, you know, if you're successful and your business lasts many years, you know, your lifetime, maybe even past your lifetime, you pass it to your kids or you sell it or whatever. These are all people that are going to be around for a while.
Yeah, I completely agree. They're relationships, and you should look at it as that. Like, you guys are in this together. So this is going to be a great segue to our next section, which is the raw truth, where we get into sharing our own gritty experiences with today's topic. We want the listeners to know that success isn't easy, and it's not pretty, but it's certainly not a straight line. We hope you're going to hear our cautionary tales and learn from them. So, Phil, I hope that you are would like to join us in our raw truth.
He's probably seen a few.
He's probably seen a few horror stories. So usually we talk about our own personal experience, but I think between the three of us, we have at least one.
I mean, we're a little biased, right? Because all of our experience have told us not to screw around in this area. So I don't know. We have our own horror stories to give.
I mean, I have one that I can at least share. So there's a person that I knew that was going to go with my company to do bookkeeping. And then his wife decided that because she was in the industry, I want to say she worked, I don't know, she was like a financial something or other. I don't know what she did, but she was like, oh, I'll just do the books. And so he came to me and said, hey, my wife said she's going to do the books. Because I, at the time, ran in a somewhat the same circle as him, I found out, and I think I told you about this yesterday, like 7 years run is stuck in my head. I feel like it was 7 years later, I found out that his wife had been filing the taxes. She was doing the books and she was doing the taxes. So she had been filing the taxes incorrectly for 7 years, and he owed so much that they ended up having to sell their house in order to pay the tax fine. And this was a home that was their forever home, which made me so sad for him. They had already lived in that house at that point, I don't know, 20 years or whatever. They had were fully established in this home or planning on growing gold, and they couldn't because of this. So that to me was a massive horror story. And I was like, all you had to do was hire someone with credentials as opposed to just going.
Well, both sides, it sounds like they needed to hire somebody who was a bookkeeper plus somebody to file the taxes.
Absolutely.
Right? She was doing both.
Yeah. Yeah. You see it a lot. I mean, not to the level of selling your house or anything like that, but there's certainly a lot of, it's tough. When you hire family members, you lose a lot of objectivity, right?
Yes.
When you have an outsider looking at your books, they're not gonna take any guff from you, right? They're gonna say, "Hey, what the hell is this expense? You can't be doing this stuff,
right?
You know, don't I don't want to see this on your books next month or something like that."
Yeah.
I mean, I've said that to clients a lot, and it's because we're not, it's a friendly relationship, but we're not necessarily friends. And I can say something like that to you. And I've got that level of objectivity there, which I wouldn't expect from my wife, because it's much easier for me to just explain something away at the dinner table. I've seen that a bunch of times too. We've had clients who, we've had to go back 6-8 years and file back taxes, and they owe, a ton of money and they don't have it. And it's, well, we thought we were doing it right. Well, I mean, this is really an area where it's not a DIY area. Mm-hmm. The accounting, the books, and the tax filings. If you have anything, more complicated than like a meat and potatoes American, where you're earning a W-2 and you're paying your mortgage and that's pretty much it. Mm-hmm. You want to talk to competent people in the fields to manage this stuff for you.
I just think that if you have a business, you should have a tax accountant.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. If you have a business, you're not simple anymore.
Even if you're starting out, if it's simple, like you think you're simple because you're just starting out, I think as soon as you have that, you already qualified for the reason of getting a tax accountant.
Oh, yeah. I love taking startup. Well, I shouldn't call them startup, like new businesses. I love taking on new businesses that are like, I just started my company. I just opened up my bank account. Mm-hmm. So I don't really have a lot going on. I know that I won't be a very big client for you. And I'm like, I don't care. I don't care if I don't hear from you again, or I don't see a singular thing for 6 months. The great news is that you've already made the most responsible step, which is hiring us. And then from there, I'm going to give you referrals to CPAs, and I'm going to set you up on the right course. So that to me is worth its weight in gold.
Yeah.
It's not so much like, So anyway.
Well, we're also held to like a professional standard, right? Like for sure. if you have a company that does the service, obviously your brand, your reputation, everything's online. So you have a own professional standard. If you have a license, and of course you also held to that standard as well. So I think you just get the help you need. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like if you're starting a business, even if you're bookkeeping, like you're bootstrapping, there's just necessary business expense that you should just budget for and know that you should incur, right? Yeah. Don't be cheap.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which we had an episode about that. Don't
we
be
sure
cheap.
We sure did.
Yeah.
Don't go into business thinking you want to be cheap. Like that's just, you're doing yourself a disservice.
It ends up costing you a lot.
Yeah,
you can lose a lot of money being cheap.
Exactly. So,
another situation, which I think is not an isolated situation, mm-hmm. was I had a client who was working with a CPA firm who was filing, and now this was years ago. I recognize that everything is really done electronically at this point. This was probably about 9 years ago. I had a client, 9 or 10 years ago, I had a client who was brought to me from an attorney friend of mine who really needed somebody to create books because he was getting ready to go to trial. And he was looking at 3 years of prison time, and they were going to liquidate his company because he had not paid. I feel like it was sales tax. I really don't remember what the tax was.
Oh, they'll really get you for sales tax.
Yeah. I don't remember what exactly it was, but 15 years of it, he had not paid.
I feel like local taxes are much worse.
Yeah. Maybe it was that. I honestly do not remember what kind of tax it was, but it was some tax that he had not paid in 15 years. Maybe it was state tax. I don't know. Whatever it was. But what it was happening was that the CPA firm was sending him the form for him to mail out, and he was not mailing it.
He didn't realize he had
he didn't realize
staff.
He was supposed to be mailing them out.
So
because we were finding them when we were going through the physical forms, because everything was on a paper ledger, handwritten. So as we were going through boxes to find ways to document things, we were finding these tax forms. And I'm like, what are all these things?
Why are they still here?
Here, like, yeah. And then I was like, oh my God. And he was like, oh, I was supposed to be mailing those. I'm like, I mean, in the end, what ended up happening, thankfully, I mean, it did end up in a good story. In the end, come to find out that he really did not owe nearly the amount that they said he owed. He was able to not, he didn't end up going to prison. He did end up creating a payment plan with the IRS, mm-hmm. and he only owed a fraction of what it was that they thought he owed. So it did end up with a happy ending, but still
except for the stress and a number of years it took off his life.
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. He actually ended up selling the business afterwards because it was such a traumatic experience that he just sold the business right after all of that was done. He sold the business. But regardless, that was another situation where he was not getting, he was with a CPA firm, but he just was not understanding what he's supposed to do.
Right.
What his part of it was.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, listen, if you have questions, ask, right? You see it like on TV, on all the pharmaceutical commercials, they always say, talk to your doctor and ask him or her questions. It's the same with this stuff, right? If you have a legal question, call your lawyer. If you have a tax question, call, you know, somebody like me or books, Savannah. You know, it's all, there's no harm in it, you know, other than, absolutely. You know, I generally don't bill people just to talk on the phone. I don't know how you guys run your businesses, but you know, it's probably worth it. Even if you are charged, you know, when the alternative is jail or selling your house, your forever home, you know, it's probably worth a 15-minute phone call. Just to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. And if you feel like your advisor or your professional isn't responsive or they don't feel like answering a question, go find a new one. I mean, I hate to say it, just because everybody has a CPA doesn't mean that they're the greatest professional out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have good ones and we have bad ones. Yeah. It just is, right? So if you find somebody where you feel like you're asking questions or you feel like they're not responsive, they're not giving you good instructions, you're not getting what you need, then it's important that you go do the legwork and go find somebody else.
Yeah, there's competent advisors out there.
Yeah,
I agree. Yep.
Funny.
So we are going to move on to our famous examples. Phil, would you like to continue joining us or?
I'll hop off if I can. Is that all right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Right. But before you leave, why don't you tell our listeners how to get in touch with you?
The easiest way is through our website. It's polygonadvisory.com. Okay. And all of our contact info is there. We've got a contact me form and info about our firm. Happy to answer any questions or answer any inquiries from the listeners today. And thank you guys for having me. This was fun.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We'll include your info in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll have you in the show notes. And I will say that I have worked with you I have worked with you as a referral partner and as a friend, but I have also worked with you with my taxes and my experience has been phenomenal. Very, very impressive. So I say anybody who would like to get in touch with Phil, mm-hmm. I highly recommend.
Thank you. That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. All right. I'll see you guys later.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Famous examples.
So in each episode, we like to connect a famous example to our discussion to help you relate our talking points on a more global and well-recognized scale, revealing the dots between the living room startup and the success story on the cover of Forbes. Sometimes we use exact examples of either famous persons or successful business owners of today or in history. And sometimes we use examples of people who've inspired us and have inspired today's discussion.
I have a couple of horror stories, but hey,
so do I.
So a couple of horror stories. I mean, it's again, I think it goes back to what we were saying before, is it's important that you trust the professionals you're working with, but it's also that you have to feel like you can trust them.
Absolutely.
So I have two examples. I have one, which is Nicolas Cage. So Nicolas Cage actually had a huge amount of financial troubles when he was hit with a $6.2 million tax lien in 2009. He blamed his financial manager, mm-hmm. basically saying that, you know, his financial manager is really what led him down to this financial ruin, putting him in a risky and highly leveraged real estate investment that led to substantial loss.
Yes.
Now, Cage eventually filed a lawsuit against his financial manager. But of course, his financial manager countersued to say that, you know, it was really Nicolas Cage that basically squandered all his fortune with excessive spending and ignored his advice.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. That must be fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the point of this one is that it doesn't matter. The person who is holding a bag, the person who has to answer for this is Nicolas Cage.
Oh, for sure. For sure. So. But, you know, sometimes the CPA accountant or bookkeeper gets blamed for the client's misuse of their own money.
Yes. So. Well, yes, that's true. And they get blamed in a sense that like this, they get sued. But, you know, for the IRS, who are they coming after? They're coming after the taxpayer, which is you. They're not going to care so much unless you're, you know, CPA or somebody has gross negligence and you want to do all that. But still, it's a huge drain of resources, both time and money.
Oh, for sure.
And then the second example I have is Gloria Vanderbilt, which is just a story of the fact that, you know, CPAs and financial managers aren't the only ones that can go wrong. Mm-hmm. So Gloria Vanderbilt, I think everybody's heard her name before. She was actually caught in a fraud and theft scheme by a collusion between her lawyer and her psychiatrist.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Talk about a betrayal of trust, right? So it basically was in the early 90s, and she actually lost a lot of money for this. They forged her signature on documents and then just blatantly stole money from her to purchase real estate in New York and such. And if I remember correctly, I was actually reading a book about her, and she was just one of those people. I mean, obviously born into money.
Right. And a legacy, right?
And she didn't pay attention to the financial stuff. Like, that was just not her thing, not her deal. She just didn't pay attention to it. And so unfortunately, like, she didn't find out until much, much later when her financial situation was really dire, and she ended up having to sell properties and assets in order to recover from that loss. Mm-hmm. Now, if I understand it correctly, she did end up recovering, because I think that was before she founded her jean empire.
Yeah. Yep.
So she basically had to make it all back. But yeah, she was hit really, really hard. And she, of course, did sue them for, you know, all the things she can possibly sue them for. And then eventually in 1993, which was like years later, the court awarded her $1.7 million in damages, even though that was... The feeling was that was way less than what she lost.
That was a drop in the bucket compared to what she lost.
Actually, like, these guys absolutely just stole from beneath, like, her nose. Mm-hmm, like, it was blatant to that point. So, hey.
Yeah.
Gotta watch out.
Absolutely.
Gotta know enough to be dangerous.
When it comes to, I love that saying. When it comes to finding famous examples of bad advice, the internet is bountiful with horror stories. And we've heard many. Over the years. And I think everyone knows that Cosa Nostra was brought down by accountants. For those who don't know what Cosa Nostra is, that's Al Capone and the like. The feds just could not get anything to stick.
Yeah, they got tax fraud.
They got them for tax fraud. Yeah.
Tax evasion, right?
Who knew?
Whatever works, I guess.
Yeah. And from that point on, there's a joke, but I'm not telling it correctly, where the FBI is just full of accountants. It really is. They hire accountants a lot because that's usually where they'll get you.
Forensic accountants,
yes, but also just accountants, just generally speaking too, because you gotta be able to take somebody down if you can't find something to stick.
You know, if they advertise that more, you think we'd actually get more people majoring in accounting?
You know, that's actually an interesting thing you should say, because there's a mass
exodus of accountants.
People who are not going into the accounting field.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to find a good accountant nowadays.
Well, it's a problem. I mean, certainly there was a mass exodus during the pandemic and everything too. And then it's also compounded by the fact that a lot less people are majoring in accounting in school. Yeah. So we're getting less new blood, I guess you can say, into the industry. And then a lot of people also exited.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there's going to be a little bit of a dry spell there for quite a few years until hopefully they can, you know, have some sexy story like this to be able to entice people back into the accounting field.
Absolutely. I kind of feel like because it's hard to find a good accountant, CPA or bookkeeper, it's become, what's the word? They're able to leverage it. Like, they can, a lot of them are charging. Like, some people I hear are charging a lot of money for their services. Because they're like,
there's demand, right? There's a lot of demand on the supply. So
anyway, all right. So Wesley Snipes. I think everyone knows that Wesley Snipes spent some time And the book.
Well, I think you have to be old enough to know this one. No,
maybe.
This is like back in the 90s.
I mean, true. True, but.
The kids even know who Wesley Snipes is today.
You better know.
I'm just saying.
If they're listening to us, they're old enough, I would think. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe there's some maybe there's some teenagers listening to us.
We're not cool enough for the young kids.
Who are like, oh, this is so cool. Anyway, so Mr. Snipes received a 3-year prison sentence for willfully failing to file tax returns for 6 years. Dang. And he avoided $7 million in taxes. That's so insane. Apparently his advisors.
Sounds like he went to jail.
Yeah, he did. He went to jail for 3.
Yeah, he tried to blame his advisors. Yeah, I remember this. Yeah.
Yeah, he tried to blame his advisors.
They told me I didn't need to file. Like, really, dude? Like, what's...
We're not supposed to file taxes.
I mean, I get it. This is pre-Google and everything, but heaven's sake.
There's never been a time you're not supposed to file taxes. Anyway, whatever. He did his time. He did the crime. And now he's paying taxes, I hope. Hopefully he fired them and hired better people. Okay. So then there is Paul DeGardis. He is dubbed as the greatest, or the biggest criminal tax fraudery, whatever in history. This guy is a former attorney. I am.
Are we just making up words and phrases this episode? I feel like that is the trend we're on. Okay. Frauderer.
Any hoozles. Frauderer. He is a former attorney as well. This former attorney received a 15-year prison sentence for helping clients evade taxes. I wonder if he did Wesley Snipes' taxes. He was convicted of creating fraudulent tax shelters, and he would create fake losses to reduce the tax bills of the extremely wealthy. I mean, we all hear of these offshore accounts, right? Well, so that's kind of what he was doing. And the tax shelter that he had created, or the tax shelters, generated $7 billion, bill with a B, in fraudulent losses, and $1.6 billion with a B, in lost tax revenue.
Oh, that the IRS probably came at him hard.
Yeah.
They're not friendly once they
No. Like I say, they're slow as a sloth.
Yeah. But they're not friendly once they get on you. Like, as they shouldn't be, right? Because if you think about it, they're kind of defending the citizens of the United States.
Absolutely.
Right? But, you know, that's kind of the way they see it, which isn't entirely wrong.
Yeah.
The money true. For
anyway. Next
please
is
don't come after us.
No.
I'm saying at the end of the day, don't come out.
I am innocent. Willie Nelson. Willie Nelson. He had a decades-long struggle with the IRS in the late 90s. And it's kind of funny how, like, all of these things happened in the 90s. Like, that's when the IRS woke up.
Well, it was pre-Google. People couldn't verify what people were saying.
I mean, but all Google of these things happened in the 90s.
Yeah. I don't know. We were fast and loose. Let's just be honest. So many things were fast and loose in the 90s.
So the federal agents seized most of his property, and they alleged a $32 million tax debt.
Oh.
Right? So he said that he got bad advice from his accountant, and that person also hid money in bogus tax shelters. I'm wondering if they're all connected. I should have.
What, they all have like coffee on a Sunday together?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe his advisor was Paul DeGardis.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Now you're just making up, like, now you're just starting rumors.
In the end, he negotiated a settlement with the IRS, and then he recorded an album called The IRS Tapes, Pulled by My Memories. Kind of like Marvin Gaye when he made that album, Here, My Dear, for his wife. It's a story. Anyway, that album was recorded as part of the settlement to pay down Nelson's tax debt. And the IRS collected $3.6 million from the sale of the album, but Nelson's career picked up from where it was left off, and he was able to pay off his debt.
Whatever works for you, man.
Hey, man, whatever. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we're going to go into our Recommendations. So there's a saying that goes, put your money where your mouth is. And we're drilling down a bit further here to connect what we've discussed at a granular level to tangible sources you can take to get you to that next level. You have more recommendations than I do, because my recommendation is hire good people. So
don't go cheap, right?
Don't go cheap.
Don't go cheap. Okay, so that's one of my recommendations too, which is kind of like what Phil said, is ask questions. Like, your advisors should, like, the good ones welcome the questions, because they know that the more educated you are, the more knowledge you have, the better they can advise you, and the more they can kind of focus on the work that needs to be done. Yep. And so if you find yourself talking to your CPA or your lawyer and you just feel like they don't really care, they probably don't.
Yeah.
Find a new one. There's plenty out there, right? Mm-hmm. And you do kind of, you know, I hate to say, like, I know they say you get what you pay for, but, you know, just because somebody was a big fancy law firm or big fancy accounting firm doesn't mean that they are worth the price they're paid either. So
absolutely,
go with your gut, figure out, like, you should know, like, who's on your side and who isn't. And of course, when in doubt, ask for referrals from people who you do know that has great experiences. Mm-hmm. And even if it is a little pricier, it's worth the money. Like I said, this is a business expense that you should expect to pay. Do not go cheap. Two things. So you know, I like to say you need to know enough to be dangerous. So all about that self empowerment through self education. But so there was a book that I thought was kind of funny. And there's like a whole line of books that comes from this. It's called Taxes Made Simple.
Mm-hmm.
Income taxes explained in 100 pages or less. These days, I very much appreciate anything 100 pages or less. But I kind of flipped through it really quickly, and it definitely goes through the basics of a lot of the need to know tax items to get you just leveled up enough to be aware of the conversation you're having. And mm-hmm. that's what you also need. And then you need your advisor to kind of help you fill in the blanks and help you understand
mm-hmm.
what else is involved. And then I'm also a big fan of like LinkedIn Learning. They have a lot of courses online. They talk about taxes, they talk about accounting, talk about business tax, business accounting, business finance. They typically have pretty good like instructors. It's you know, it's in a course like format and things. And the great thing about LinkedIn Learning is that if you don't subscribe to it, your local library probably has a free subscription. So go get a library card and then sign on.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
My suggestions are going to be about hiring the right people, as you say. The way I measure whether or not I'm going to have a successful relationship with any professional service provider is, would I go out for a coffee or a beer or, you know, whatever. Usually it's would I enjoy a cup of coffee with this person? And if I feel like I would enjoy a cup of coffee with that person, then that's the person I'm going to work with. I feel that way about my financial advisor. Mm. I feel that way about my CPA, who happens to be Phil. And I guess I feel that way about myself because I'm the bookkeeper.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think that like a great testament is like, they need to be willing to give you advice you don't want to hear.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That's a pretty big thing, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because I have definitely gone to my financial advisor with some cockamamie ideas of mine where I'm like, you're going to love this. And then he's like, what the heck just came out of your mouth? And I'm like, oh, okay, well, I thought I was smart about it.
But it's like, film. It's like, don't do that again.
Please, no. Just no. A no.
But those are good. Those are good signs. Those are signs of a good advisor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I say take your time. And just as he said, you would ask people for your financial advisor, like you would ask people, who do you go with or who would you talk to? Mm-hmm. Or maybe there's a company, maybe there's a business owner that you admire, or maybe there's a person that you admire. Mm-hmm. And in the way that they run their business, ask them who they're working with. And, you know, that doesn't mean that that person is going to work for you. Maybe that person is not going to have the right kind of personality for you, but it's a good place to start. And I do also recommend that you start with a good team. So if you have just started your business, I don't want you to think that you have to go it alone. As we talked about in our last episode about going cheap can actually be very expensive. It's true. Find a bookkeeping firm that will work with you, even though you don't have a lot to work with right now, because you're going to, right? And it's nice to have a good team that can grow with you. So be mindful of that. That's probably the best advice I can give.
I would say that's pretty good advice though, right?
I think
we hawk on the, like we talk about this so much only because, and you probably run across this a lot too, is mm-hmm. I've come across some very brilliant business owners, like mm-hmm. absolutely brilliant, off the chart genius, like business owners, great at what they do. And for whatever reason, when you come to the money finance part of their business, like they just shut down.
Yeah.
And they ignore it, they shove it to shut. I don't know. It could be an intimidation thing, or it could be like, you know, personal, what do you call it? Personal beliefs about yeah. money, limited mm-hmm. beliefs on money. I don't know what it is, but I see that happen all the time. And you can't afford to do that in business. You just can't.
Yeah.
Right. So that's just something to you know, if you need to give yourself a little kick in a butt,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we're trying to give you a little kick in a butt right now, well, but
you know, and the best advice yes. is to listen to a good podcast.
Put us on repeat until you get the kick in a butt.
For sure.
To kind of face up to this. It's not that hard. Everybody's smart enough to figure it out. It is not rocket science by any means, but it is a lot to figure out. That's why you need the advisors around you mm-hmm. because you can't know everything. And like I keep saying, you just need to know enough to be dangerous.
That's right.
All right.
Please join us for our next episode where we will discuss how to prepare for a business loan. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about business loans. We're going to talk about grants, just borrowing money in general.
Finding capital. Finding I like
capital.
This.
Capital. Yeah. Finding capital. You know, what are some ways in which you can utilize the world around you? Maybe your city, your county, your bank. I don't know.
Well,
but whatever it may be.
Organic growth is great, meaning that you kill what you eat. Is that what they say?
Like you
eat what you kill?
Kill.
Yeah. Whichever one comes first, whatever. Anyways,
yeah, you eat what you
the
kill.
Point is like organic growth, meaning that you just take the income from your business,
yeah.
whatever's left over, you reinvest it and you grow that way. It's great, but it is slow.
Yes.
So a boost in capital will kind of get you accelerated a little faster yeah. down the road. And there's nothing wrong with that. Just understand it. And
yeah.
hopefully in our next episode, we will help you understand it.
Yeah. And I mean, we're going to talk about, what we can on a local level. excuse me, that if you're listening to us nationally, meaning outside of Fairfax County, Virginia, if you're listening to us outside of Fairfax County, Virginia, perhaps you can take the advice that we give and use it where you live.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really looking forward to that.
That'll be fun.
Yeah. So please show us your support by following us on your preferred podcast platform. I had no problem with the beginning, and yet somehow.
We're not editing any of this out.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, social media and YouTube. We'd also, you know, we'd love it if you would consider sponsoring us, because we want to be able to bring you better everything. So there are things we want too. So if you would be interested in sponsoring our
better everything. I
yeah,
love
better
it.
Everything.
Better everything.
So just email us. All of our information is that in our show notes.
Yeah.
So consider being a sponsor and let's talk about it. And we'd also
we have a sponsorship package.
We do. We do.
Let's talk. Yes.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Not for nothing.
No, absolutely not. We'd love for you to also share our episodes along with sponsoring us. All of our links are posted below. Until next time, mind the business behind your business, because all great successes start small.